Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. Now we are going to talk about the current situation in Sri Lanka. After months of protests, the country's lawmakers have chosen a new president. Six-time Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe was sworn in as acting president last week and is set to serve out the next 2 years of the former president's term. This development comes after thousands of people stormed the former leader, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, official residence in Colombo. He fled the country last week. The newly appointed president said he will crack down on the protesters, calling them fascists. Sri Lanka is on the brink of bankruptcy. It owes more than $50 billion to multilateral agencies, including the IMF, foreign governments, and commercial creditors, and it's running out of reserves. So what are the root causes of the economic crisis in Sri Lanka? What is next for the movement that ousted the last president? Who is the new president? Joining us with the latest is Marlon Arahasinghe, senior assistant editor of Himal South Asian. That is South Asia's first and only review magazine of politics and culture. Marlon has covered the anti-government protests in Sri Lanka since they began in April. Hi, Marlon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. So just a little bit of information about Sri Lanka. It is an island country of almost 22 million people. About 11% of the population make less than $3 US per day. A quarter of the public is in need of food. According to the UN, more than 70% of the population has reduced its food consumption. Do all of those facts sound about right to you?
Yep, they sound about right, yes.
And can you just tell us what daily life is like right now? I understand that people have been standing in long lines, sometimes for days, to get petrol. Hospitals are running out of medicine. What more can you tell us about daily life?
Yeah, I think it's correct to say that we are very much in crisis. The economic recession, I mean, began, I think, about 8-9 months ago. And the inflation rates have skyrocketed. We've had severe shortages of fuel, gas, and of course, essential items such as medicine and medical equipment. So this has been going on for some time now. So, for example, we are getting daily power cuts. At one point, about a few months back, they lasted for more than 10 hours. Right now, it has come down to about 3 to 4 hours. And as you rightly mentioned, there are people standing outside of fuel sheds. Even right now, they're lining up. Still, the fuel distribution has not begun yet. We have gotten a new shipment, we are told, by the Minister of Energy. And the ministry officially stated, you know, not to line up outside queues. But people are helpless. People are just, you know, even without the fuel sheds having fuel, they're still lining up waiting for fuel. So that's the current state right now. And there's suffering, I guess, all across the board. And especially the daily wage earners, small businesses have been hit the hardest.
How did Sri Lanka end up with more than $50 billion in debt and an inability to import basic necessities?
Well, I guess an economist would be able to explain this better than me. But so we have been taking debts for, you know, over the last 10 years and even before that. And I guess the debt situation got worsened, especially because of the pandemic. And of course, in 2019, there was the Easter bomb attacks. These all of it influenced the economy of Sri Lanka greatly. But then I think one of the main causes for our current situation is severe economic mismanagement, which stems not just from this government, but from the previous two governments as well, and also rampant corruption. And these are, you know, these have been identified as the main causes for the current situation. Yeah, so I guess, like I said, there's a lot of literature out there by economic analysts about Sri Lanka. And I think, you know, especially in the last months, there's so much analysis that is out there. And, you know, we have practically become like a case study or like a cautionary tale of what not to do. Now, for example, I can talk about one of the misguided decisions that were taken last year. So last year, when we were still reeling from the aftermath of the pandemic, the president took this decision to ban chemical fertilizer in the country. This was like an overnight ban, even with a lot of opposition against this. I mean, this is a 100% ban, and it impacted our agriculture industry severely. And we are currently facing, there's a looming food crisis that we are facing. And one of the reasons, or one of the main reasons, is because of this ban. And it was estimated that 20% of domestic rice production fell in the first 6 months. And the government was forced to import, I think, $450 million worth of rice. So this obviously, there was a huge cost to this misguided decision. This also negatively impacted the tea and rubber exports, which usually bring in much needed foreign exchange. And I think the government had to pay over $300 million in compensation and price subsidies to farmers who were impacted by this crisis. Like I said before, even this is being touted as like a case study. Sri Lanka is a case study for how not to implement organic farming. So, I could talk about another decision which was taken by the Central Bank of Sri Lanka late last year. So one of the decisions the governor took was to artificially inflate the rupee, which led to a huge discrepancy in the selling and buying rates of the dollar within official financial institutions like banks and in the actual market. And this also gravely impacted foreign remittances, because that's another way that Sri Lanka gets foreign exchange, through Sri Lankan migrants. And they stopped using official channels to send money, and they were resorting to alternative methods because it was more profitable for them. And it is reported that in the first quarter, remittances declined by a massive 58% compared with 2021. So these are some of the decisions that we can cite which led to the current crisis. But of course, like I said before, this crisis stems not just from the decisions that this government took, but from the previous two governments as well.
Can you tell us more about these protests and this movement, when it began and how it has changed over the past couple of months?
Yeah, so I think the protests began early this year. I mean, there was general discontent across Sri Lanka, and there were, small mini protests which were happening in fuel lines. While people were waiting for gas, there were mini protests happening, at different points across Sri Lanka. This was even, as early as end of last year. But this kind of organized, or I would say organic movement came about in the capital mainly in early March. Again, there were many protests that were organized by like neighborhoods, for example. They would just go out into the streets and they would hold placards, and it would be like they were dubbed silent protests. But then it changed March 31st when we had like our first, I guess, big protest. This was in Mirihana, close by to the president's residence. When that happened, there was also a lot of protesters, a lot of Sri Lankans, from all over Colombo who came to Mirihana to protest against, the current government and, of course, the president. And then later that evening, the protests turned, a little tense as well, because the police, they got involved, and riot police got involved, and they started, deploying tear gas and water cannons on peaceful protesters. And then this ended up with a bus being burned. And we have footage which shows that that this was done by like external parties. But since then, the protests developed into a different kind of animal, I guess. And then protesters, they occupy Goldface Green. This is in front of the presidential secretariat and the president's official residence in Colombo. So they occupied this space, and they basically built like a small village there. Well, it is called Gota Go Gama, which means Gota Go village. So they've been protesting for over 100 days at that particular location. And there have been mass protests that were happening from time to time. For example, on May 9th, we had a mass protest, but again, which spread all throughout Sri Lanka, which resulted in the resignation of the Prime Minister. And then on June 9th, as you might have seen on international media and local media, again, hundreds and thousands of people poured into the capital from all over Sri Lanka, and then they demanded the resignation of the president, and they occupied these government buildings like the presidential secretariat and also the official residence of the president. Then later on at night, the Prime Minister Vikramasinghe's residence was also burned. So this sent like a very clear message, I think, to the government, and of course the heads of the government, that the people are discontent and there needs to be a change. And this is what precipitated Gotabaya Rajapaksa's fleeing the country through very elaborate means. And I think it's almost like a film how it unfolded, what Gotabaya did and how he fled the country. That's like a brief summary of how the protests developed over time.
Yeah, thank you for that. And you know, seeing the photos on social media of what happened after he fled with the people in the official residence were just incredible. I mean, how is this? Would you say this is a monumental moment? Has anything like this happened before?
Yeah, I can't remember, or I don't think this has happened ever before in the history of Sri Lanka. So I think the protesters and Sri Lankans in general, they feel that this is a very, very significant moment in time, in history. And I think it's that feeling which brought most of these ordinary people who were, as I said before, who were suffering from these great economic difficulties. Some of the scenes were incredible because you saw people from all over Sri Lanka. When there's a fuel crisis going on, when there is a lack of public transport, and when there was also a curfew that was declared. So June 8th night, there was a curfew declared. And then it came out that the curfew was illegal. And then it was lifted at 6 a.m. So there were people who were waiting in train stations who wanted to come to the capital in order to stage their protest. And the station masters, they actually refused to let people use the trains. And they pressurized the station masters to get the trains back on track, literally. And they got them, they got the trains working, and they got to Colombo. I was on the ground that day, and it was just incredible scenes. And I have never seen that much of that many people, congregated in one spot in Sri Lanka and calling, in solidarity, I think, for the movement also, calling for the resignations of the Prime Minister and the President. So, yeah, very significant moment in our history.
Today, we are speaking with Marlon Adiasingha, Senior Assistant Editor of Himal South Asian, South Asia's first and only review magazine of politics and culture. And we're talking about the latest developments in Sri Lanka. It also, you talked a little bit about the wide range of people that were on the streets. And we've read that there were students, trade unionists, Catholic nuns, Buddhist monks, farmers, middle-class professionals. What really, when you look back at the interviews you did, when people, took over the official residence in Colombo, what really stands out for you and the conversations you had with people?
Whenever you talk to these people on the streets, it's almost the same in the sense that they all feel the same economic pressures that everyone else in the country is feeling. So, and they have come out, some with their families, some with their first, babies. I had a friend who was pregnant, and she was continually went for protests, right? And when she was like advised by her doctors not to do so. When you talk to these kind of people, what they say sounds as if, it comes from some sort of like an inspirational, like a quote, because what they talk about is like, this is, we are not going to get this opportunity again. We have to stand up for our country. And so there was a sense that, like I said just before, that this was an important historic moment and everyone wanted to be a part of it. And everyone was feeling this sort of the suffering and the distress that we had and the anxiety that people were feeling were almost kind of let out. Their frustrations were let out when they came into the streets along with fellow Sri Lankans who have been experiencing the same. So it was almost cathartic in a sense.
Tell us a little bit about what happened and how the country's lawmakers chose a new president. Tell us more about Ranil Wickremesinghe. You tweeted that he represents the ruling political elite. The Guardian interviewed a 53-year-old toy exporter, Anura Gunaranta, who said Ranil will be chased away. He is a crook and does not have a mandate. This protest movement is going to get worse. There has to be an end to this. And the only ending we will accept is throwing Ranil out, whatever it takes.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, at least the protest groups, they identify with that sentiment. Because for the last 6 months, they've all been clamoring for the resignation of Ranil Wickremesinghe, along with Gotabaya Rajapaksha. Yes, the key demand was Gota go home, which obviously meant for the president to resign. But then another key demand, which was as equally important, I felt, to the protest groups, was Ranil go home, or they wanted to see the resignations of both Ranil and Gotabaya. So I think it's difficult to gauge the public sentiment at large right now, because I think we are still trying to figure out what just happened. Because I think there was a sense of optimism once Gotabaya Rajapaksha, and the way that the kind of incredible way that he had to flee the country, that there would be some sort of realization, at least in the parliamentary sense, the ones in power would realize that this sort of political conniving, the kind of political games that they have been playing up to this point, it had to end. But then what we saw, I think, yesterday was another one of those, political, like a staged political game for all Sri Lankans, because it was very clear from the start that Ranil Wickremesinghe did have the majority, because the Rajapaksha-led SLPPE, which is the governing party, so the SLPP MPs, they pledged their support to Ranil Wickremesinghe. So the outcome was almost, I guess, was quite predictable. But I think the people and protest groups especially, they thought that there would be some sort of, I guess, learning for the parliamentarians, that they would vote according to what was, the sentiment on the ground. But what we saw yesterday was all the SLPP, the governing party, rallying together and, electing Ranil Wickremesinghe, who actually, came to the parliament with just one seat. And then he became prime minister and now he's the president. So I think there's a clear, in terms of the protest groups, I think they have stated very clearly that they are going to continue the protests. And even yesterday, there was when Ranil Wickremesinghe was appointed, there was a silent protest at the main protest site in Colombo. So I feel that the protests will continue, like the gentleman said, and people will not be satisfied with what they have gotten right now, because I think people are calling for a systems change. And this is not what they expected. So I think the next steps are already being kind of formed by the protest groups. They realize that the current crop of parliamentarians will not cut it, in the sense that there needs to be elections, because right now we are seeing a parliament, especially even with the presidential elections, we are seeing a parliament that is deeply fractured, and there are lots of divisions within the governing party and the opposition as well. Although the governing party and certain members of the opposition did rally together to elect Ranil Wickremesinghe, but they did so to kind of continue this status quo. And this, I think, is not acceptable to the people, and especially to the protest groups. And I think this is, in my opinion, elections need to be held as soon as possible, so that the people's mandate, what people have been clamoring for on the streets, because we saw unprecedented amount of people going to the streets and protesting against this government. So the people's mandate need to be reflected in the parliament. So I think elections are the way to go.
Marlon, before we let you go, can you tell us about the challenges journalists face in Sri Lanka? There have been reports by Reporters Without Borders and other media advocacy groups about journalists being attacked during the protests and social media sites being blocked.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And I think there's a lot of documented evidence that's out there, especially during these protests, because we saw that there was excessive force that was used by the police and also armed forces. And I have said this elsewhere, but this doesn't come as a surprise to any of the Sri Lankans, because there is an inherent culture of violence and culture of brutality, which is part of the armed forces and the police. So, and this is something that the North and East have this type of intimidations they have experienced for decades. And it's the South is seeing it, I think, for the first time, and they're realizing, what people in the North and the East have been complaining about or been telling us about is actually true. So it's like a light bulb moment for the South. But when it comes to journalists, so the problem is journalists, most of them, are in the thick of things in the sense that they are there when this type of incidents of brutality happens. To document and so that there is evidence that this type of brutality it takes place, because there over the past few months we've seen the armed forces and the police continue to deny that they used excessive force. I mean, they always use the term minimum force was used, even when they shot protesters in one of the protests in Rambukkana, where they actually, one of the protesters died. Even when they shot protesters, they used the term minimum force was used. So the problem is, I think it's very precarious for journalists who are out there, because I was on the 9th when the mass protests happened near the PM's residence this is the private residence of Ranil Wickremesinghe, which was burnt later on. When there were protesters who were there, they were the police were firing waves after waves of tear gas at them, and there is documented. I mean, there's footage where journalists were attacked. One of the female journalists who belonged to Syriza, who was basically kicked, and she fell on the ground, and they continue to kind of beat her. So I did not see that, but I was, I was there, and I was also running back, and I saw one of the cameramen getting hit by a police baton. So this it's quite precarious for journalists who are out there on the ground reporting, especially because when excessive force or when the police resort to means of brutality to control the crowd. Then the journalists who are reporting are also they will also be subjected to it. And I think all the reporters or all the journalists who are on the ground would tell you quite a similar tale. And I think each and every one of them would have gotten tear gas at least once in the past 6 months. So it is quite precarious for them out there.
Marlon Adiasingha is senior assistant editor of Himal South Asian, South Asia's first and only review magazine of politics and culture. Marlon has been covering the anti-government protests in Sri Lanka, and you can find out more about his work and Himal South Asian at yourcallradio.org. Marlon, thank you so much for joining us, and we'd love to have you back.
Thank you, Rose. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. We'll be back after this.